Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I wasn't sure there'd be anyone here, so it's nice to see some of you. I wanted to start by just saying a little bit about the Newtown massacre. You know, we live in such a turbulent world. It's a troubled world. And I think, particularly as a Zen center, we should spend just 30 seconds and send our loving kindness to Connecticut. Let's do that. When you think of something like the Newtown Massacre, it raises certain questions. At least to me, it says, how should I live? What kind of person should I become? How can I help others most effectively? Those are deep questions. It's easy to float through life and never ask those questions. In our Zen Center, we do. So I'm going to talk a little bit about being generous, how we can help others, and maybe a direction that we can take our life in. And I'm going to start with a very brief summary of Zen Buddhism. This will probably be the briefest summary ever in history, but I know there's always somebody here who is not too familiar with the history of Buddhism. And remember, Buddhism started about 2,400 years ago in India. The first century of the Common Era, it entered China. We're not quite sure how. There's a northern route called the Silk Route. There was a southern maritime shipping route, and it probably came in both ways. And one characteristic of Buddhism in every place it's been is that it merged with many of the prized cultural values of the country it entered. And when Buddhism entered China, it blended with Taoism and Confucianism. And many of our Zen ideas about nature, the self, spontaneity, come from Taoism. And many of our rituals come from Confucianism. Then about the 13th century, at least our kind of Zen entered Japan. And Dogen Zenji, as a young man in the early 13th century, had studied in China and brought our kind of Zen to Japan. And then in the 20th century, particularly the early 1960s, as far as we're concerned, Japanese monks brought Soto Zen to the New World. And I think of Suzuki Roshi, for example, in San Francisco, Katagiri Roshi, who was the founder of this temple, and also an assistant to Suzuki Roshi, brought Soto Zen to the New World. And now it's one of the most popular forms of Buddhism. And if we're going to answer the question, you know, how should we live? What kind of person should I be? Zen provides some clues in its very nature. For example, its simplicity, very simple. Its emphasis on the ordinary. And sometimes you come and you think, ah, nirvana, you know, exploding novae in the sky, but very simple. It expresses great matters of life and death and tragedy of all kinds, etc., in terms of the here and now. We're not talking about heaven or hell or karma or the future. We're talking about learning to live right here, now, this very moment. And that's what Zen's about. Above all, it's a practical method. It can be practiced by anyone, anywhere, at any time. And that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit. You don't have to be a Buddhist to practice these methods. And in fact, today, there are all kinds of interfaith dialogues with Buddhist practices. And in fact, many of the practices, particularly some of our meditation and healing practices. You'll find people teaching them and never using what I call the B word. That is the Buddhist word. You know, no Buddhist. And so we find that there are Episcopal ministers, very famous ones, who are also Zen priests. As part of our training here, well, we spend 30 days someplace. And I spent, I was supposed to be silenced, and I spent, there's a story there. I spent my 30 days up at St. John's. And I made the mistake of telling all the priests up there that this was a silent retreat, so they wouldn't talk to me. And I can be a chatty guy. And so I talked to some of the students, etc. But there were all kinds of Tibetan lamas walking through campus. And every summer there were retreats by Tibetan lamas. When I went into the library, you know, you go into a library and there's always an exhibit of books to read. The books to read were all about Buddhism. And there's a St. John's Press, and one of the books, you know, about learning to be a monastic, etc. I had two priests on the cover, and they were, you could see their back, and they were walking down the path of St. John's. And one was a St. John's priest that you could recognize. We saw them all the time, and the other was a Tibetan Lama, etc. And they're all, you can be a Catholic, you know, Jewish faith, whatever. And I just want to emphasize that, because sometimes you say, well, if I come here and I learn these things, do I have to become a Buddhist? Certainly not, etc. And maybe eventually that B word will slide off someplace. Well, this raises a question with the, you know, our origins with Japanese priests like Katagiri. How should we practice Zen? And how can we learn to be the person we'd hope to be? And in the East, and with Katagiri and Suzuki Roshi, etc., the idea is that if you were going to practice, you went into a monastery. And oftentimes you did this when you were quite young at 12, but there was also a pattern in India. I think I followed that pattern, you were a young kid, you know, then you started the business, you got a family, you know, you had a successful business, and you retired, and then you entered the monastery. And then you entered a priestly life, etc. But we're not going to enter monasteries. Very few people do, etc. We're primarily a lay movement. And even though we call ourselves priests or whatever, and we have a rakasu and things like this, we are lay people. We're not monks. We're not living in a monastery, etc. And so the result is that we have to start rethinking our practice. That if we're going to practice the Buddhist way and we're not entering the monastery, and basically, how do we go about doing this? And again, to return to the idea of practical everyday events, a place to start when thinking about how to live, basically, is to ask, how can I live my life in this very moment? And realize that every moment is just unique and, in a sense, extraordinary, if you will. So we want to take care of small details. Fix the leak in the faucet, etc. Wash the car. Believe it or not, all of those are Zen practices. And let me give three examples of the kind of practices that we might do. These are not related to generosity, but just the general practice of Buddhism. And Gary Thorpe's book called Sweeping Changes, Discovering the Joy of Zen in Everyday Tasks. And people who read this book, you love this book, in a sense, because it's all about doing ordinary things around the house in which you learn to put yourself in the present moment, just doing things. And again, I think of Nirvana and those exploding novae, and here's a chapter called The Way of the Broom. You know, you expect great things. Let me just read a little bit. Could anything be simpler than sweeping your own floor? Complications arise only when thinking interferes with the performance. When you become too conscious of your actions, too careful, you can encounter a kind of nervous, negative energy. Even sweeping the floor can become awkward and ineffectual if done with too much care. In other words, you're not doing things spontaneously in the moment. You're trying too hard. You're thinking too much. For you to find your own natural place, it is helpful to stay in touch with where you are now and what you are doing. Try not to let your thoughts carry you away. Keep bringing yourself back to yourself. The repetitive motions of sweeping a floor can be a good method for practicing this return. Try doing some simple sweeping without noise, without past or future, without premeditation, without stricture, without aim. Just move the broom. When you sweep in this way, you develop attentiveness rather than mere intention. All things are moved along and guided by the traveling broom. Its path determines the path of all that falls before it. Before long, you might lose yourself in the gentle rocking motions of this easy sweeping. Your style of sweeping and the reason you sweep can reveal much about your character. Are your strokes generous and open, or are they short and tightly controlled? No matter how or why you sweep, you can bring sincerity and art and joy, notice the word art, and joy into this singular experience. Wonderful book, Sweeping Changes. Another practice that you find in a lot of Zen centers is the practice of cooking and eating. And there's a wonderful book by Ed Brown called The Complete Tassajara Books Cookbook. The head cook at a Zen center is called the Tenzo. I think we have a number of people here who have been Tenzos in the past. And I'm not going to say much about it, but if you read Ed Brown's book, you know, the care in cutting vegetables, how you cook, what you choose to cook, etc., becomes a real practice. And then the third way one can practice in wherever you are at any time is what's called the Four Immeasurables. Now they have a fancy name, the Brahma Viharas. This is a practice of sending loving kindness, the practice of compassion, the practice of joy in others' attainment without, you know, prejudice, etc. And finally, the practice of equanimity. And Saturday mornings, the first and third Saturday of every month, we actually practice, we have a guided loving kindness meditation. And you say things like, let's say you're thinking of a person who's ill or needs help of some kind. And you say, may that person be happy. May that person be healthy. May that person be safe. And in parentheses, from bodily and financial harm. So, you know, say things like this. May that person be at ease with all beings. And it's just a wonderful practice. You can do it anywhere. Loving kindness is a wonderful practice. You start by thinking of somebody you admire very much. And you get this feeling of loving kindness in you. Yeah, I love it. The little voice in my head said, battery low. That may not mean anything to you younger people. Battery low. By the way, my hearing aid actually plays music. And so it's got a little button on top that I can push. And so things get really boring. You see me go like this. You know that I've slipped off someplace. So think of the Four Immeasurables. You know, it's something you can practice. What's a real difficult practice is a compassion. Because in a compassion practice, you're bringing harm and hurt into your body. And then you're trying to purify it and send it out. And one of our members works as a couple's psychologist. And so he works with deeply grieving people all the time. And he tells me he can't bring that anymore hurt into his body. So he has to go around his body and then out. But those are wonderful practices that you can do. And So if you're going to choose a practice, you want to think about several things. You want something that inspires you. You know, why do something just because everyone else does it? Is it cooking, for example, or whatever it might be? You want something that's obtainable. And you don't want to set your goal so high that you just can't do it, etc. And it should be practical, you know, something that you can do wherever. No monasteries for us. Though about one out of 50 people, maybe, maybe it's more than that, who become a priest actually do end up going to a monastery in Japan. Well, today I'm going to concentrate on the six perfections. Now, this is the way of the Bodhisattva, and it's a way of practicing to be a certain kind of person. And these are listed on the very front of your brochure. And today I'm going to talk about generosity, and then in the next five talks I give, I'm going to talk about each of the others. And you'll see when I talk about each of the others and every one, I'm going to say, this is the most important one. This is the most important one. And if you look at them, it's generosity, morality, patience, effort, meditation or mindfulness, and wisdom. And if you think about them, these aren't extraordinary aims. I mean, what's the opposite of being generous? It's being stingy. Well, you know, if you develop yourself, you're not going to be a stingy person, right? And then think of morality as compared to being a sinful person, if you will. Or what about impatience? You know what I mean? So these are just kind of the qualities that we think of in Buddhism that should typify a person who's really kind of on the path, if you will. The six perfections basically are a practice in the Mahayana tradition. And I wanted to say just a little bit about that, because talking to some people the last few weeks, I could see that there's a little misunderstanding of what the word Mahayana means. Maha usually means great or big, something like that. And so sometimes Mahayana is thought of as the great or best or right path, if you will, as compared to Hinayana, which is considered the lesser path. And you can actually read this in some books. But what Mahayana, rather than great or big, Maha should really be all-inclusive, and that's the difference. In the Hinayana, you know, some people work for meditation, and the goal is not, this is traditionally, not basically to free all beings. But Mahayana, again, we say our goal is to free all beings. All beings can, walk the path, if you will. I say traditionally because today in the West, some of the most loving and kind people are actually in Hinayana institutes or what have become, and we have those roots such as the Insight Meditation Centers, where people like Robert Aiken, just write beautiful books, about how you can help other people. Well, before I talk about generosity, etc., I want to talk about two misunderstandings that we run into in our practice. We hear a lot about, and in my view, they get in the way. And the first misunderstanding is that there's no effort required. And you hear this in certain ways. You are perfect just the way you are. You are a Buddha sitting on the mat. You hear this all the time. You shouldn't read. Things like this. And that's really a misunderstanding. And I'll say why in a minute, but I spent 3 years working with a Tibetan teacher, Ted McLeod, who wrote a wonderful book called Wake Up to Your Life. He asked me once what we did, and I says, well, we don't have to do much. We just sit in the mat, and I'm a Buddha. And he looked at me incredulously and said, good luck. Good luck, if you will. So effort's required, lots of effort. If you read the three pillars, when they talk about Zen meditation, and this has never happened to me, and I've been here since 1976, he says if you're really doing shikantaza, if you're really meditating, you're sweating. you know, with the effort of concentration, etc. Well, I've never sweat. Sitting on, if anything, I fell asleep or whatever. Geshe Rinken, in his book on the Six Perfections, in the introduction says, to dream of reaching a destination is not enough. You must pack your bags and set out on the journey. Wonderful. You have a number of metaphors, such as the path in Buddhism, about where you're going. And one of my favorites is the idea of the raft. And the idea is that we're crossing a river of samsara, and we get to the other side of nirvana. And that's a wonderful image. But if you've ever been on a raft, remember these turbulent times, so this is not a lazy river, right? And you push off from the shore, unless you pull hard, they pull, no oars, they pull, etc. You end up in the ocean, and off you go in the ocean, if you will. And the raft image, is very important to me because it's hard to pull a raft across a flowing river by yourself. And so you need your Sangha members with you. And this is the importance of Sangha. Now, they embrace you, they help you, get basically across the river. And the idea is, of course, and this is just interjection here, something that I've just discovered the last 4 or 5 years, the idea is you get across the river and you've conquered the three poisons, and this is greed and hate and delusion, things like this, etc., and you're lounging on the beach along the river, and you look up, and in back of you is this great, great mountain. The path goes up, and that's the third part of our Mahayana path. And I'm just talking about the first part. The first part, you're conquering things like attachment, dislike. You're understanding the emptiness of the world. But the latter part, which is often, as far as I can tell, and we see this in the Diamond Sutra, is the hardest part of all. And that's realizing that there's no one to teach, there's nothing to teach, you're not a person, etc. How do you do it? How do you save all beings, etc.? And that's very hard. And the Diamond Sutra is all about that. The second misunderstanding is kind of a black to white transition. And that is, they tell you what's bad, and then they compare it with what a Buddha sees. With what a Buddha sees. And I don't know what a Buddha sees myself, etc. And there's a wonderful teaching in Buddhism called the Three Views. We keep them always in mind in our practice. But the first view is a false view. You've not put your foot on the raft yet. You've not set out across the river. You don't realize you could be different. You could help people in certain ways. And then there are two right views. And the second of the right view is the view of a Buddha. And that's what you hear about all the time. You know what I mean? Is that there's no merit. You're perfect just the way you are. That's the understanding, the right view of a Buddha. But the first of the right views, you're on the raft. You're heading across the river. And when you're doing generosity work, they say, if you're a Buddha, of course, no merit. You just do it. But you do need encouragement. And there's nothing wrong with feeling good, if you will. And if you look at the Diamond Sutra, there's all kinds of merit, etc., that you can earn for your effort. But the difference is that you don't keep that merit yourself, but you send it off to somebody who could use it. At one time, we have a little bulletin board on the wall as you go in towards the restrooms, etc. At one time, that was a merit board. And what you'd do, you'd come for the day or the week, and you'd say, all the merit of my effort this week is going towards, let's say, those children in Newtown, etc. It's just a wonderful, wonderful practice. So think of the three views where you're in between. You don't quite get it. You feel sentimental. All of that's fine. But this is where a really good teacher comes in, because a good teacher's not going to say, be a Buddha. You are a Buddha. You know what I mean? You need no merit. You need no support, etc. But that teacher's going to help you along and help you pull across that river, etc. So I think that's kind of important. Well, let's say now something about the first of the six perfections, and that's generosity. And as I said, by far it's the most important of all the perfections, etc. It's called Dana, D-A-N-A. After the talk, we have a Dana bowl over here of generosity, etc. And it's called Dana Paramita. And the word paramita means a virtuous quality or some aspect of character you want to develop. Now, there are many books on generosity and on the six perfections. And I think of a book called The Giving Heart by Mary Ryan, for example. And here's a book by Rebecca Shafir, I think it's just really good, called The Zen of Listening. And there's just a lot of literature, and all you have to do is go into Amazon and put in listening. Or put in generosity, and you'll see. And they're quite detailed, so all I'm doing today is dipping my toe into this conversation and hoping to encourage you to look into some of this. Well, what can we give? In our materialistic world, our scientific materialistic world, the first thing that comes to mind is things, stuff, if you will. And we can give money. But we can give our labor, our time. You know, those are things. In the fall, when school starts, we'll try to do something with the Joyce. I don't know what it's called.
Food.
Yeah, we get kids for kids like backpacks and things like this, and giving stuff is very important because you can't follow the Dharma well if you're hungry and abused. If you're hungry and abused, you're not going to sit on the cushion and think about saving all beings. And when we give stuff, we give stuff to everyone. When my talk is over, we're going to give the Bodhisattva vows. All beings, beings are numberless, vowing to free them. It doesn't say, I'm going to try to free some of them, the ones I like. Etc. It doesn't say that at all. So we can give stuff, and that's very important. But we can also give other aspects of ourself. One I really like is from Norman Fisher, and that is we can give happiness, our happiness. And it sounds kind of strange when you first say it, but when he's now abbot of Everyday Zen Center in California, but when he became abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, somebody says, well, what's your goal? What are you going to try to accomplish? And he says, I'm going to try to be happy. And people say, well, that sounds kind of strange. And he says, well, I was in a monastery for several years with a very crabby abbot. And I was very unhappy. He says, if I'm happy, people around me are going to be happy. And so this is something that we can really practice. And that is, try to be happy. And it sounds... A lot of this sounds easy, but it's hard. And you wake up and you're crabby. You got to go to work. You know what I mean? My granddaughter's car is always breaking down, and so I have to go to high school and pick her up. You know, there's lots of reasons in life to be kind of crabby, but make an effort to be happy. Another way, a practice of generosity like this, is giving random acts of kindness. And we hear a lot about that these days. Somebody wrote a book called, I think it was Mary Ryan wrote a book called Random Acts of Kindness. And there's actually one day a year, a Random Acts of Kindness Day. Some people do it. My wife, for example, when she's in the coffee shop, she'll say, I'm going to buy coffee for the third person in back. Just a little thing. For me, one of my real breakthroughs came in Lund's checkout line at the supermarket over here. And I used to go there, and there was always some little old person. When I say that, I got to be very careful because I'm getting a little older. But anyway, there's always some little old person talking away to the checkout person. And I'd get real impatient. Come on, let's go. what are you standing? And she was checking out three things, you know, a little piece of cheese, two apples, you know, something like that. And it suddenly occurred to me one time that there are all kinds of apartment houses around that area. And this person probably sits in her room, or his room. Now, their one real conversation with another person during the day is that checkout person, right? And they look up, and there's a guy like me sitting there, oh, come on, come on, you know. And so I've always given a sign now that I'm reading the magazine. I want to finish it. Go ahead. You know, something like that. Another area that's hard for some of us, and that is that those the people who kind of cut in line when you're driving your car. There's a place on when you go on 36th Street, you take a left and you're getting on 35W. And there's a line to the left that's left turn only. And then everyone else gets in the right, and of course it's chock full, and it takes forever to get through there. And there's always somebody who sneaks up on the left side and then jumps in front of you. You know, and people got kind of upset. And I've just decided, okay, you know. So there are all kinds of ways to give random acts of kindness, and it's something you can do basically every day. Well, let me talk about another way. And the main thing I want to talk about, and some people here are very good at this, and this is giving the gift of listening. And particularly in the holiday season, it's one of the greatest things we can give. Doesn't cost anything, lots of effort, most of us don't know how to do it, etc. It reminds me of something Rosemary said, and I've said this in four or five talks, and every time I say it, I thought, oh no, I'm saying it once again. But it struck me just powerfully. And Rosemary said, whoever she heard it saying, said, what's a conversation? It's one person talking and the other person waiting to talk. You know? And that's just stuck with me. You know. And I heard that a couple of years ago. And I find myself sitting there waiting to talk, and I always remember that. And so what we're talking about now is mindful listening. Listen to everyone, if you will. Remember, save all beings, if you will. And there are a number of ground rules, and we don't have to remember any of these, but some of the you know, the simple ways to be mindful and listening is don't interrupt. I can be an interrupter. You know, we figure, I know what that person's going to say, right? And so you interrupt. So don't be an interrupter. Don't take the subject off in another direction, particularly your direction. And I remember one time, a woman came back, and this was some years ago. There was a horrible storm in the Boundary Waters area, and trees came crashing down. And this is, no one got killed in this story, but a tree landed on their canoe. And if you've ever been in the Boundary Waters area, if you don't have a canoe, you know, it's hard to walk through those woods. This is the very southern edge of the boreal forest, and it's not like going through a maple woods or something like that. And furthermore, you walk 100 yards and there's another lake. You know what I mean? And so she was telling me how her and her fiance bonded. I mean, this really brought them together, working. And all the time I wanted to say, well, let me tell you about the time I got lost in the woods. you know, training, you know, changing this. Don't make it about you then, and don't go off in it. Don't get into internal distractions such as judging. It's easy to do. Disliking. I mean, and I'll say more about this in a minute. Don't interrogate. Now, I have a friend, Tom, and he's an older guy, and he has this habit when he talks to people, they'll say, oh, yeah, you know, I worked in so-and-so, and he starts asking them tough questions. He wants to see how smart they are. You know what I mean? No one wants to talk with Tom. don't preach. And I wrote in here, as an enlightened Zen priest, let me tell you. Don't give advice, and this is one of the hardest things, unless asked for. Because most people, when they talk to you about a problem, you know, they're not necessarily asking for advice. They just want to talk it through. They've thought about it, etc. And it's just kind of human nature to say, do this, I do this, etc. And then there's just two more. Check with them. Did I hear you? Did you say this? You know, a lot of times we don't understand, particularly when your hearing aid says battery low. That's another problem. And so that's a good one. And so I find myself saying, And then the last one I really like is follow the two-question rule. And that is always ask two questions about that person before you start talking about yourself. And so you can imagine two Zen priests get together and they're going to ask two questions. And no one wants to talk. You first. But anyway, you get the idea. And I find that's just an excellent rule because it gets things going, etc. And then another thing is pay attention to basically the barriers to your listening. Are there certain kinds of people you don't want to talk to who have maybe disabilities? Are there gender issues? Are there age issues? Are there racial issues, etc.? Things like this. All of these can be a problem. What about status differences and somebody dying? Now, there's a nice little story about Zen Master Kaichu in Japan about a century ago, and the mayor of Kyoto, his name was Kiligali, came and gave the Zen master's attendant his name, and after said, "Mayor of Kyoto, emissary of the emperor," on and on and on. Zen Master Kaichu looks at it and says, "I don't have time to talk with this person. Tell them to go away." You know. So the attendant brings the announcement back to Kiligali, who looks at it and thinks for a while, and then crosses off all of those things behind his name and says, "Take it back to the Zen master." And the Zen master looks at it and says, "Ah, Kiligali, my good friend, show him in. I'd be delighted to talk with him." You know, I've always liked that. Ken McLeod, who I mentioned I studied with for a while, talks about recognizing pattern imperatives in listening and talking. And that is, watch yourself when you talk with a group. We'll have cookies and coffee and tea. And, what happens when you walk into a group? Do you try to grab part of the discussion? Do you try to change the topic? Whatever. Or with an individual. These are called pattern imperatives. And they're often so tightly ingrained into our body, into our habits, etc., that we don't really recognize that that's the way we talk, that that's the way we listen, etc. And so identify imperatives. Listen to yourself as a practice is another a good way of listening, and it's a way to start. And when you sit on the cushion, part of what we do is a shikantaza. Our real Zen way of practicing is just open awareness. You know what I mean? And these thoughts just come up. And just, what are those thoughts? What's going on? No negative self-talk, non-judgmental, etc. Another practice, and one that we've done here in the past many times, is called using the listening stick, or the rock, or the little Buddha. And that is, let's say that there's a controversy going on in the Sangha or whatever, and you want everyone to speak. And so you sit in a circle, and the only person who talks is the person who has the stick, right? And then you pass it on. Norman Fisher, who I've talked about, and I listen to a lot of his talks, after a talk, he breaks people into groups. And rather than just having the groups just talk to each other, let's say there are three of them and you have 40 minutes or 45 minutes. Every person gets to talk for 5 minutes first. And that person times it so that there's not somebody else sitting there looking at them, waiting. You know what I mean? So everyone gets to say what they want to say for 5 minutes, and then you enter into a general discussion, etc. So that's still another way is to try to determine the listening books like this one. Try to determine what a person's movie is, and that's the way they put it. All of us live in different worlds, and for everyone in the room, there's a different world. We have different backgrounds, different wishes, different upbringings, different desires, things like this. So what is their movie? Years ago, there was a great coffee house, one of the first espresso places in Minneapolis, and it was on Hennepin, and I always forget that little street, near the library up there, and it's been long gone. And there was a wise old dentist who was part of the coffee group. And all kinds of people would come in. I mean, all kinds of people, get coffee, talk for a while, etc. He told me one time, I had a friend, John, and John was spiraling off into mental illness and actually spent a number of years in institutions. And I see him occasionally now, but he comes out once or a few days a week and things like this. And John would come in, my friend John, would come in and he would say, I had a great morning. He says, I was down at Lake Calhoun meditating, and then the mosquitoes came and they were ready to bite me, and I put a force field up and I could see them just bounce off of it. You know what I mean? There was another guy called Tom, and Tom would say, oh, that's stupid. That's ridiculous. You know what I mean? And our wise old dentist just said that when you speak to people, that's what it means speaking to them. When you speak to John, that's what it means to speak to John, that he's going to talk that way. And this is the idea of getting into their movie. Where are they, etc. Everyone is different. And so when you speak to people, you just don't talk to them, but you try to feel where they are, right, and what they want. Well, and I'm almost finished here. Develop a daily practice. All of us have to toughen up our listening muscles. It's not easy. We're not trained. We don't know how. I have a plan. And all of these things are things that you can do every day. You can try to talk with somebody. And, of course, all of this, you have to do it sensibly. When you go get coffee and the barista says, what's your order? And you say, well, how's your day? So you have to bring some smarts to all of this. All of this reminds me of a little saying that I read in a Zen book. It says, why were we given two ears and one mouth? And one wise Zen master says, that's because we should spend twice as much time listening as talking. And another Zen master says, it's because it is twice as hard to listen than to talk, etc. So tuck that away. I haven't mentioned meditation practice, but I wanted to say something about that, because meditation practice is at the very foundation, the very basis, basically, of what I'm talking about. Learning how to talk, learning to be generous, listening to yourself. And basically, there are two parts of meditation, at least basic meditation. And the first is cultivating attention. You should be able to hold your attention on something for long periods of time. Because how can you listen to yourself? How can you listen to somebody else if you can't hold your attention? And I've taught courses where people say, oh, my mind flits all over the place. I just can't concentrate. And so you have them work on really cultivating attention. And so we count up to 10. And when I count, I tend to count up to 21 when I'm counting, etc. Just to hold it, just to hold it, just to hold it. Just be attentive. And then the second part is to use that attention to develop awareness. To develop awareness. Because you can hold your attention. You can see what's coming up. You can listen to another person. You can be more aware. And this is why we say the very foundation of our practice is our meditation practice, etc., to get ourselves prepared. So back to the raft in finishing. Are you ready to cross the river? Have you put your foot on the raft yet, etc.? What kind of person do you want to be? Are you ready to be a bodhisattva, etc., and make the effort, etc.? And this sounds kind of hokey, but make a New Year's resolution. Be generous. Be kind. Thank you very much. We have time, if there's just a talk, maybe someone can say something who has experience on listening and being generous, or maybe go ahead.
I actually don't. I just want to thank you for your talk, and I'm actually really looking forward to tea and coffee and cookies. I'm curious to see how
it works. When I used to be a Doan, occasionally I'm a Doan on Sunday morning, occasionally, but once a year I'll say, now if you're new here, and you go in to get cookies and things and coffee, what you're going to find is a whole group of people with their back turned to you. And they're all talking to each other. Because they've come a number of times, they've had friends, they have people to talk to, etc. And And so be proactive. But you're right. Here's a chance to practice listening. Of course, no one will want to say anything, right?
Yeah.
Okay, any other comments or questions?
Thank you for your
talk. Yeah? In terms of keeping your happiness, there's certain people you don't run across, and if you listen to them, you sort of lose your happiness.
Lose your happiness? Well, that's why I like the three views, because maybe a Buddha, the third right view, I can always be happy. But most of us, we're right to that first right view. We've stepped on the raft. We're going to get grouchy. We're going to not be happy. We're going to cause somebody pain by saying something that you regret later. I remember a number of years ago, we had a big dispute on the board here, and it had to do with selling Hokioji, the land area. And somebody new came on the board and said, we're going to start all over. We gave it away. They said, no, we're going to make money. And we had spent 2 years working on this proposal. And so I, in my infinite wisdom, said harsh words. And I says, no, we worked on this. This is what we're going to do. Don't interfere. So the next day I jump in an airplane and I fly to Seattle, where a good Buddhist friend of mine is. And I went into his house, library full of books. And I picked one down at random. It was something like The Marvelous Words of My Marvelous Teacher, something like that. I flipped it open, just flipped it open, and there it said, harsh words. And it's, those who use harsh words will be swallowed by sea demons. don't beat yourself up. That you just work and work and work. It's like the four viharas I talked about, or a loving kindness. That you practice and practice, and one reason why you start with a person you love. You have yourself, a neutral person, etc., is not that, of course we're sending a loving kindness to these people. But this is a concentration and not a virtue exercise. And the result is if you do this full-heartedly for some time, your natural response in any situation is loving kindness. Okay? And that takes a long, long time. Right? And so just realize, I did it again. I was in the conversation, I interrupted. And that's part of our practice. It's not easy. And that's why I say the first thing is this kind of myth that there's no effort required. Big, 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 big effort. Big effort. And this is where you need a sangha. People, friends you can talk with. You can talk about some of these things. Okay, any other? Yeah?
Can you just list out again the three views? Name them.
What's that?
The three views. Could you just restate them? Not
I'm trying to remember. My hearing aid has died, so but I'm trying to remember which three views I was talking.
You mentioned the two right views.
Oh, the three. I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. This is a very important part of our practice, and you don't hear it talked about enough. This is the wrong view and two right views, okay? And the wrong view is that you don't understand. You're caught by the three poisons of greed is big, but attachment, wanting, etc., and then dislike or hating. The way people and delusion, etc., not realize thinking of ourselves as a whole. Essential being, all of these are wrong views, etc. And then the third view I mentioned is the view of the Buddha, and that's the view we hear all the time. When they say, when you're trying to be generous, you're trying to be happy, etc. A Buddha acts perfectly, right? But it's the first of the right views that we have an inkling. Basically where we're going to go. But when we meet a grouchy person, we get angry, right? That we've not reached that yet. And if we're trying to be generous, and people say, do it with no idea of gratitude, etc., well, that's not always helpful. You know what I mean? You might want to say, it makes me feel good, and that's good. But you're crossing the river. You're crossing the river. And if you train with a good, experienced teacher, and that's very important, to help you along. It doesn't rush you. They see where you are. Remember, you can enter the Buddhist path wherever you are. Somebody can say, well, my life is so screwed up or whatever, that maybe in a year when things get better, I can jump on that raft. You start right where you are. You know what I mean? And who knows? Maybe things will never get better. But what will change is how you see that situation. And sometimes there's this misunderstanding again in Buddhism that I'm never going to feel pain. You know what I mean? Nothing bad is going to happen to me. And my child is not going to die. You know? But that's not so. You know, there's a difference. And I always like this example that, you hit your finger with a hammer, and when's the last time I've had a hammer in my hand? But hit your finger with a hammer, it hurts. You feel pain, right? But suffering is when you say, oh, son of a gun, I'm going to, on and on. It's all this extra psychological overlay. Unnecessary. Of course it hurts. You know what I mean? And it's the same thing when something happens to you. And it doesn't mean that as a Buddhist you're a rollover. It doesn't mean any of that. It doesn't mean, oh, somebody said something bad to me and I'm going to say, ooh, none of that. There's a lot of tough love in Buddhism. Tough love in Buddhism. Well, I think I've talked enough, and I thank you very much.